By the way, these weren't fact checks, so don't come up to us afterwards and say, no, Jimmy Carter didn't say that. Neil Simon said, the only thing Californians read is the license plate in front of them.
And here's Joan Didion. All that is constant about California is the rate at which it disappears.
Yes. And then there's James M. Cain, the author, who said, we only have two kinds of weather in California, magnificent and unusual. And we promise you the magnificent while you're here.
You all know California is the land of extremes, earthquakes, drought, wildfire, mudslides, and more. Novelist Don DeLeo said, we can relax and enjoy these disasters because in our hearts, we feel that California deserves whatever it gets.
Ouch. Well, you know, actually, we forget about climate change and droughts and wildfires because there actually is some breaking news, a man-made disaster in Southern California. Brad and Angelina are breaking up. So I'm sure you're all following that.
Speaking of celebrities, Ted Danson won't be able to join us, but we have a bunch of other great speakers tonight and throughout the conference, including Baba Brinkman, an actual climate rapper. Like it says in your program, will now be able to join us Saturday night. So if you haven't registered yet for the Saturday night dinner and dance party, there are still a few seats available. Just check at registration.
So I trust that everybody has had a chance to see the artwork that we had over displayed on the side of the room here. And I want to thank the artists for joining us. There's still a few who are here. So give them a round of applause for joining us. And a special thank you to Julie Didion, who helped to organize this for us. And Julie is over there. So thank you, Julie. Really wonderful to have you here. So now it's time to get serious. As you can see, as you know, we have Governor Jerry Brown here tonight. And we're very happy about that. So he's in the middle of his fourth term as governor. He's a rare political icon who is a longtime leader in environmental policy, and he's passionate about climate issues. The governor has to rush back and sign many more bills. They're stacked up on his desk, and he likely has a bad case of carpal tunnel syndrome. But he's joined us here tonight. He'll say a few words, and then he's agreed to take a couple of questions. So we polled SEJ members earlier today, and Carolyn and I will pose the questions to the governor after he speaks. So everybody, please welcome Governor Jerry Brown. Thank you for coming. Welcome.
Well, thank you, and thank you for coming to Sacramento for your confab about journalism and the environment. I think it's a good topic. The two aren't completely congruent because, as journalists, you're interested in news, and the environment is not new by its very nature. It's about the whole system itself, and while change is part of the environment, the understanding of something this complex and this encompassing doesn't fit in our usual categories. We tend to be rather linear thinkers, moving from point A to point B. Something encounters something else, so something occurs as a result. News, as I've heard for many, many years, is not dog bites man, but man bites dog. So it's the unexpected, it's the explosive or the fresh, something that is a little out of the ordinary. So those are some of the rules. And as I try to understand news, I've been trying to understand it for the last 50 years, as a matter of fact. You might not appreciate it, but I'm a student of news. And the very concept of news and the very tight rules that govern what is news and what isn't. Because if it isn't news, you can't write about it. And your editors won't print it. So you have to fit within this, I don't want to call it a metaphysical concept, but I'll call it a construct of news. And it changes in different places, and different papers have slightly different versions. But I'd say that the very idea of news needs to be understood by contrasting with its opposites. And I juxtapose to news ritual. That's another thing I've studied for more than 50 years. I once studied to be a Jesuit priest. We had a great deal of ritual. I won't go into what the rituals were. They, too, have changed, and that has consequences. But the idea of ritual is very important to understand because it's so different than news. The essence of ritual is invariance. Invariance. So a ritual term that is used by a religious community will be preserved not over decades, but over centuries and even millennia. And the characteristic is of a community giving collective voice in their congregations to these ritual propositions in a certain way. And another key element besides invariance is that it not be verifiable. You don't say at 10 o'clock on Sunday morning, we believe that the gross domestic product will grow by 4% next year. You utter propositions that are unverifiable by their nature. And that's why they endure so long. They cannot be exposed. They cannot be deposed. And that's the beauty of ritual, which I rather like, as a matter of fact. Now, news, on the other hand, is all about variance and change and instability. And news, unlike the basic Hebrew prayer, which was discovered being uttered by some Chinese 2,700 years later, maybe one of the lost tribes of Israel or somebody, but they stuck to the utterance. Now, when it comes to the news, well, we got to have it. I always learned that after one news cycle, it's gone. The metaphor I always heard was it's like a ripe fruit in the sun. It's rotten within about 6 hours. So if you're a candidate and you master that art, you know you got to have something new every 6 to 8 hours. And that's what you call re-leading your story. And we did that. I did that a lot when I was Secretary of State. We'd go around and write press releases, and then we'd take one of the paragraphs from lower down in the story, and we'd bring it up and make it the first line. And then if we couldn't get away with that, we'd send it to another city. And then if we sent it a little later, the guy at AP had already changed, so we could send that out again, and they'd push it through the whole system. Anyway, that's news. And I just want to kind of lay the foundation between news and more constant expressions of humankind. But applying this newsy construct to the problem and the challenges of the environment, particularly climate, a lot of things that are of deep concern are not that exciting. You know, Donald Trump is more important is more exciting for many journalists than climate change. That's one of your infirmities, too. That's that because you can make a lot of noise, and then that makes for a certain amount of news. The threats and matters that are not right in front of us are very hard to bring forward. So whether it's climate change, which is way off in the future, or a nuclear catastrophe, or a financial meltdown, all the things that are big, because the implications are so serious, many of them are remote. And while they're remote, there's a lot you can do about them. But while they're remote, it's very hard to get anybody interested. And it's also hard to know exactly what to do. So the less information you have, the more ability you have to do something about it. The more you know, oftentimes it's too late. And so I like to think, I like to think about what things should we be thinking about that right on the front burner. Now, when it comes to climate change, for example, it wasn't very long ago that it was very hard to get anybody to write about climate change. I would give some very interesting statements on climate change. I would stand next to prominent scientists. They would release reports, but it wasn't news. You just couldn't get anybody to write about it. Well, that was a couple of years ago, and now with the Paris Agreement, with a lot of things that are going on, there's a lot more news. And I would say that when I just signed a couple of bills, one on short-lived climate pollutants and one on our new enforceable goals in California for the year 2030, bringing down our greenhouse gases to 40% below 1990, there were a number of newspapers that put that right across the front page. So that was news, not only because climate change has become more salient, but because it was, to some extent, controversial, because oil companies and others were trying to stop it. Now, of course, maybe if the oil companies had embraced it, it wouldn't have been controversial, therefore it wouldn't have been news, therefore you wouldn't have reported about it. So we have to thank people for small favors. So a little bit of controversy goes a long way. Too much undermines what we're trying to do. But when you look at the news and the news about climate change from the professional journals, and you read about the accelerated melting and instability of Antarctica, both the east and the west, more in the west, but they're now even saying the eastern part of Antarctica can melt, not within 1,000 years, but in a much shorter time frame. And then you look at Greenland and what's happening there, and the prediction that used to be 1 foot of climate change by 2100, then it started to be 3 feet, and now very credible scientists are saying 6 feet is more likely by the end of this century, 6 feet. And some would say it could be even more than that. It could be less, because we're dealing with nonlinear phenomena that have tipping points. And those are hard to write about. That's why I started to suggest why the environment is so different. It's everything is related to everything else. It's not objects so much as it is relationships. And when something goes wrong in the ocean or something changes in the atmosphere. And so that, and when one set of predators are stressed, then something happens in their particular niche that has consequences. I mean, try to put all this together, it's very complicated. But people have been trying very hard. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change put out reports. And then, of course, a lot of people wanted to say, well, they're just doing that to make money. And it's all a fraud. And so there were some email controversies out of England. And there's a great deal of news. And I often, I don't so much anymore, but I used to, on Sunday mornings, go on Google and type in climate change or global warming. And I always found invariably that a third of the stories were debunking climate change. A lot of them came out of Australia, some of them came out of London, some of them came out of America, and other places. So in the effort to report both sides, you have to report the debunkers, as well as the more peer-reviewed and genuine, what I would call genuine scientists. And that becomes a problem, because there are many sides to the story, but that side is not, as Mr. Trump says, it's all a fraud perpetrated by the Chinese to maximize their exports. So, but that gets coverage, and there are many, many millions, if not tens of millions of people who believe that. So the great challenge is how to report facts about climate change, facts about the environment that are interesting, that fit within the construct of news, and help to educate. Because at the rate we're going, we won't achieve the goals that we know scientifically to be necessary. We have to step up the pace. And it's very hard to step up the pace unless there is a strong belief, understanding, and support for what that step-up requires. And what the step-up requires is a decarbonizing of the economy, which is a shift in agriculture, transportation, manufacturing, tourism, entertainment, residential living, business financing the whole thing. So there's a lot of change that is required that will demand tremendous understanding and consensus in order for us to get there. World War II, on a day, President Roosevelt said, no more passenger cars. The United States is building tanks and ships. It wasn't very long before Henry Kaiser was putting out a Liberty ship every 30 days. And the tanks were rolling off the assembly plants in Michigan and other places. So that was a real turn. But if you look at where we are, the world's got a billion cars. A fraction of that, less than 1%, are zero polluting, zero emission. And we got to get that up, and we have to get it up at a certain rate of speed. California has goals to achieve that. They're steep, and they will get steeper as we go down the road. So we need the technology, we need the investment, we need the public collaboration, and we also need the understanding. And that's where journalism comes in. Can we communicate through our traditional channels in a way to raise sufficient understanding and consciousness? I would say right now the jury is out on that. We don't know. We hope. And that, I think, leads to the next point, that the fact that things are going okay doesn't mean that they are going okay. I'm reading a book that I find very fascinating, entitled Sleepwalking. It's about World War I, how we got into it. I don't know if you saw that. But my big takeaway from Sleepwalking and how we got into World War I is that very smart people, very prominent people, do stupid things. So I'm always asking myself, what prominent people are doing stupid things today? What are the stupid things that we're all doing? You know, at the state, federal, national level. And my hunch is that there are some. And they are pretty they could be catastrophic. Remember, I think it's good to see, think about World War I for a second. These were smart people. I think a lot of them had a classical education, studied history, Latin and Greek. Many of them were going to the same church or a very similar church. And some of them were related. They were cousins. And yet, they all marched off with prayers to the Almighty, with bands playing, and with utter enthusiasm. They just marched off. And there it was. And it didn't take very long for the Russian Empire to fall, for the Prussian Empire or the Austro-Hungarian Empire to collapse, the Ottoman Empire to collapse, to redraw the Middle East in a way that is still causing tonight untold bloodshed. And that was all done by people who studied Latin and Greek in college. We went to the Anglican and Catholic and Orthodox Church, and they really screwed up. So, are we smarter? Are we more virtuous? Are we more disciplined? Are we more visionary? And it's pretty hard to make that case. So that's why you got to work harder. You got to get the word out when you see something stupid. And not the little stupidities, but the big stupidity that sets our society off in a direction that is not sustainable. So environmental reporting is really fundamental. It's so important because many of the things we're doing don't have the public support. They're not about funding a school. They're not about a crime. They're not about, you know, explosive situations that occur in some of our cities. But they will be. Over time, the shifting of the temperature, the shifting of the seas, the unpredictability of the extreme of the climate has a huge effect. So in California, we are doing some things. It's pretty far-reaching, both in green chemistry, in our goal to regulate short-term climate pollutants like methane and chlorofluorocarbons and black carbon. We're doing that. And as a matter of fact, scientists tell us that if the rest of the world would do what California is proposing to do by 2030, we'd cut the pace of climate change in half. In half. That's how powerful the super pollutants are and how powerful it would be if we can get rid of them. But you can't do it unless there's a sense for it. In California, we're still profiting from the smog of Los Angeles in 1950. Smog was so bad that the politicians of both parties started demanding action. In fact, there was a guy, there's a supervisor in L.A. County in the 50s. His slogan was SOS, save our state, stamp out smog. Well, by the time Ronald Reagan got to be governor, he signed the Air Resources Act. Richard Nixon signed the Clean Air Act. And by, California had a special prerogative to announce and enforce its own rules on auto emissions. And so we did. And because of that, we developed the scientists, the regulatory capacity, and the habit of dealing with the poisons that our industrial society generates every day in our atmosphere. So we are charging ahead in that regard. And because when the auto companies collapsed, their breakdown, 2008, they were able to be brought to the table, and the California standard was actually adopted as the national standard. And that happened because of the experience, the news that everybody knew in Los Angeles that things were bad. Well, now we've cut we've increased the number of cars 3 or 4 times. We've cut the pollutants by more than 90%. And we can do a lot better. And so can the other states, and so can the other countries. So that's a matter when you can turn a problem into a solution, a lemon into a lemonade. And we need these problems, but we don't want them so catastrophic that we can't really respond. And I would say the news of climate change is coming in. It is based on scientific papers. The events of heat and forest fire and flooding, those are the events of the day. But the real news is the peer-reviewed science that tells us and puts into context the implications of what's happening and what's around the corner. And that really is the challenge, the trick. Can you bring forward the future that doesn't exist and so inspire and educate the citizenry that we take the tough actions, the enlightened actions, to make sure that future that we now see doesn't occur. And so that's the exercise. It's bringing the future forward and then feeling it, experiencing it, and making the difficult and wise decisions now so that that future we can now see doesn't occur and doesn't certainly occur in the way that we're now predicting it to. So that's the story on climate change from my point of view. California, I would say, is doing far better than most, but our steps are very tentative and very small compared to the magnitude of the problem. And so we have to continue, and it will only get more difficult, and others have to join with us. And the others are not just a few other states, but all the other countries of the world. And that was the exciting consequence of the Paris Accord. And that happened. That was a lot of work, but there's a certain amount of luck there. I mean, if President Xi and President Putin didn't come together and take the lead, it wouldn't have happened. If it didn't happen, we don't know how many years or decades we might not have been set back. So at least we have the thrust, we have the predicate for real news, because there's more of an event, and it's more real. And we are at least asking everybody, put up, tell us what you're going to do. So people are watching. Now it's up to journalists to be able to report that and keep us all on our toes. So it's a very exciting time. California is doing what it can. We need to do a lot more. But we can only do what the world of news makes plausible, in some ways makes possible. We are not disembodied political spirits pondering the eternal verities. We are politicians surfing on the surface of your stories. So please, do your best and allow us to keep going. Thank you.
Thank you, Governor. We have a couple questions for you.
Okay, Governor Brown, how would you continue to push for climate action on climate change in a Trump or Clinton presidency?
I would push in the same way I'm doing now. And in fact, that answers the question.
Short and sweet. Next question. The federal government just issued suggested guidelines for autonomous cars, and a lot of the companies doing this work are in California. Are you concerned about this new trend, or do you think it's going to be a net positive?
So this is one of these technologies that very smart people, very skilled people, have a better understanding of. But from the range of people who are very excited about this prospect of autonomous vehicles, I would say, and by the fact that the federal government has now come out with their regulations, this is a real potential. And it's a potential that can not only help the economy, can help reduce congestion, but also can reduce pollutants. That as more car, and by the way, these cars can be, in many cases, will be electric cars. If you're not paying for the, if they're driverless, it's done by computers, machines, that will make it cheaper. If it's cheaper, and you don't have to have an 8-hour day, you can have a 20-hour day. So that means you can run the batteries longer. You can run at a lower cost. You can move people around. And if people find out they can call their autonomous vehicle, and it's a lot cheaper than having a car, and then you get another person or two in it, pretty soon you reduce parking, congestion, pollution, and you actually save money and make the whole society more productive. That is, assuming the proposition is correct, that a robotic driver is better than a human being because it doesn't text, it doesn't drink, it doesn't stare, and it doesn't get distracted. So if this artificial intelligence and this high-powered radar signaling system works, hallelujah. It'll be a great day, and I can assure you California will take the lead and pave the way.
Could we ask you one more question?
Since I didn't really give you the full answer that you wanted in the first question, because I'm still thinking about it.
So California has ambitious greenhouse gas reduction targets and renewable energy goals. What stands in the way of achieving those goals?
Inertia. The journalists not writing properly about the environment. Writing boring stories that nobody reads. Not convincing their editors that they should be on the front page. Stands in the way is this is a shift. You know, there used to be a term, I remember hearing about it a few decades ago, it was very common, paradigm shift. That word used to be thrown around. Well, a paradigm is a pattern. And there's a pattern in how we all live, how we perceive things, and it's it persists because it's strongly embedded in who we are, in our built environment, and all the rest. So we're talking about changing that. And that's expensive. That takes creativity. That takes a great deal of political will. And what we're talking about is imagining a future, bringing it forward, and preferring it to today. You know, to today's news, today's pleasure, today's excitement, the now. So we have to take care of business, and we have our daily tasks. But we also have to have the vision of how do we sustain what we're doing. And We know that life is change, but we all get caught in a certain stasis or way of doing things. And we do have a way of doing things. You know, in California, we require our 32 million vehicles to go 335 billion miles every year and consume 18 billion gallons of gasoline and diesel. Now, to say, okay, gang, let's cut that in half, or at least part of it, get new fuels, different kind of cars, maybe you live closer to where you work, that is a transformation. And the transformation, it takes time, but it takes some shock to the system. Some people can't stop smoking unless they get a heart attack. Then they get the willpower. Well, we need enough of a shock that wakes us up but doesn't knock us out. So that's what you have to deliver. You have to deliver that sense. Or at least somebody's got to deliver it and you got to report it. I guess that's the proper way to balance what you do and what I do. So it's going to take a change on every level. Schools, manufacturers, political personalities, entertainment, international relations. This is something that is so global and so just everything is a part of this big whole, which is the ecology, the environment, the atmosphere above and the soil and the ocean below. That's what it is. And so we've got to deal with it. And it's very hard to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. But something like that is what's required.
Thank you. Governor Brown, thank you. Back to signing the bills. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Governor Brown. Now I'd like to welcome Helene Dillard, Dean of the UC Davis College of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences. Dean Dillard is an accomplished scientist and a National Women of Color STEM All-Star. And she's a hands-on dean who spends her time tagging fish and fly fishing. And I also just learned that she did her master's thesis on lettuce. So let's have Helene.
Thank you. And welcome to California, which I believe is the most beautiful state in the nation. You are visiting one of the most diverse states in this nation, and I hope over the next few days that you get a chance to experience as much as possible. California is home to multiple habitats, including grasslands, wetlands, tidal zones and salt marshes, scrublands and forests. But I want to take a few moments today to explore California's environment and the issues that we currently face. California lays claim to 840 miles of general coastline and 3,427 miles of tidal shoreline. But our marine life is struggling in an increasingly acidic environment. Ocean acidification from greenhouse gases is drastically affecting the relationship between predator and prey. For example, ocean acidification makes it harder for sea snails to escape sea stars and impairs the snail's ability to escape. And those small sea snails help keep the algae in check, and they play a big role in the overall balance of the marine ecosystem. Rising salinity is not just a problem for sea creatures and coastal dwellers. Soil salinity is also rising, and most plants are finding it increasingly difficult to extract the water from the ground. Increased levels of salt can disturb the balance of nutrients in the soil, and some salts are actually toxic to certain plants. Many of our conventional crops are not salt tolerant, and they will eventually die under saline conditions. And that's important in California because half of the world's fruits, vegetables, and nuts are grown in this state. We produce over 400 commodities, and California is the only U.S. supplier of a major U.S. supplier of tomatoes, broccoli, almonds, walnuts, pistachios, grapes, olives, and figs. But drought and climate change challenge the livelihood of farmers and ranchers and the accessible food we take for granted. California is home to approximately 33 million acres of forest. And yet, right now, there are 66 million dead trees in the Sierras. Years of drought and an alarming increase in bark beetle infestation have weakened the pines and other trees. In 2015, approximately 900,000 acres of forest burned. Fires used to be nature's way of keeping forests healthy by taking out the sick and weakened plants. But due to fire suppression and climate change, the fires have become way more destructive and frequent. And catastrophic fires are changing our landscape, and shrubs and grasslands are growing where forests should be standing. Forests are a carbon sink. They absorb more carbon dioxide than they release, and they reduce atmospheric greenhouse gases by about 25% globally. So when forests are destroyed by fire, they return that stored carbon to the atmosphere that we all share, which increases the effects of global warming and the likelihood of more frequent intense fires. It's a self-reinforcing loop. And because of drought and other effects of climate change, the forests are becoming a very vulnerable carbon stock, precisely when we need them the most to offset the carbon emissions. Some of you are going to be seeing Lake Tahoe on your field trips. It's the largest alpine lake in North America and the second deepest lake in the nation. Last year, Lake Tahoe recorded its warmest temperatures since 1910. For the fourth year in a row, the water in Lake Tahoe failed to mix to its full depth, and only 6.5% of the year's precipitation in California fell as snow, the lowest amount ever recorded. California was once the home of millions of salmon, and now many of our salmon runs are listed as either threatened or endangered. Some scientists are predicting that wild salmon will become extinct in the Central Valley in less than 85 years. The good news. The good news is that researchers at UC Davis in the College of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences and scientists around the world are working with the farmers and ranchers, the environmentalists, the industries, the public agencies to find practical science-based solutions. Our plant breeders are developing drought-resistant crop varieties, and our experts are exploring promising ideas like deliberately flooding farmland in the winter to replenish the groundwater and the aquifers. Our restoration ecologists are healing the land with creative solutions, and through those solutions, they are replenishing the soil and using plants that can survive the dry years and maximize water during the wet years. Our forests are moving themselves upslope to survive, and we don't plan to accept the idea that the salmon are going to disappear in California. Environmental scientists are working with farmers to restore the rivers and create beneficial opportunities for young salmon, using rice fields to provide a safe habitat during the winter when the crops are not grown. We are optimistic, and nature is resilient. We just need to slow the pace of the change to give nature enough time to adapt and science enough time to create the solutions. Small changes in behavior by everyone could, in fact, save the world. These climate change issues are all connected, and we are all connected. So your role is in creating a solution is really, really critical. Journalists are the conduit between the researchers and scientists and the general public. We need you, the journalists, to talk and write about climate change and environmental issues and connect the dots to show how acidification affects the inland farmer and explain why the city dwellers should care about the loss of forests to fires and infestations. People all over the world are working on solutions, and we need you to share those ideas and tell the story of the need for global change. So as you explore our great state this week and enjoy the coast in Bodega Bay, the crystal waters of Lake Tahoe, the bounty of agriculture in the Central Valley, the amazing wine in Napa and Sonoma, and the sweeping golden foothills, I challenge you to look at the broader environmental picture and think about how you can use our research and findings to empower the public to embrace the charge that we can help nature heal itself. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Dillard. And now it's my pleasure to introduce my boss, Rick Etchison, the President and General Manager of Capital Public Radio.
Thanks, Joe. I will be brief. Welcome to Sacramento. I would like to add something that someone else said about California, though, give a little balance. Ronald Reagan once said, if the pilgrims had landed in California, Plymouth Rock would still be undiscovered. I agree. It's controversial. At Capital Public Radio, we're doing our part to improve the air quality of the region by playing classical music and jazz on our music station, 88.9 FM, KXPR. I hope you'll have a chance to give it a listen while you're in town. We're proud to play an integral part in the cultural and intellectual ecosystem of the greater Sacramento region. In the last few years, we've added a number of reporting initiatives to our news and information service. We've launched a healthcare reporting initiative, a food and sustainability beat, in addition to the environmental reporting beat that we have, and of course our public policy reporting. All of these initiatives are arguably environmental reporting as they are inextricably linked. We live and work in one of the most environmentally rich and interesting places in the world. It's a place of amazing diversity and incredible abundance, but its sustainability and balance is very precarious. For example, we're reporting on yet another year of drought and fires, but the greatest environmental threat to Sacramento continues to be our vulnerability to catastrophic floods. The work you do as environmental journalists is incredibly meaningful and important. On behalf of all of us at Capital Public Radio, I wish you a stimulating and successful conference, and I hope to see many of you Saturday night at our special edition of Science Friday, NPR Science Friday, with Ira Flatow at the Mondavi Center at UC Davis. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. And now we just want to take a quick minute to thank this year's sponsors. Hold your applause until the end. SCJ is grateful for enthusiastic and generous support from our academic host and sponsor, the University of California, Davis. And we appreciate the warm welcome that they've given everybody. It's been very nice. And, of course, we're looking forward to spending time with UC Davis faculty and exploring the campus over the next few days.
And many thanks to our media host and sponsor, Capital Public Radio, which has a long-time commitment to environmental journalism, online at capradio.org.
And this conference would not have been possible without generous advance support from the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation.
And thanks also to the Walton Family Foundation.
And finally, many thanks to Earth Day Texas for sponsoring all the audio, visual, and session recording technology for this year's meeting. So now you can applaud.
And we've got a great lineup of exhibitors, indoors and outside, plus some ride and drive events. Make sure to make the rounds to all of them. Next up is Sacramento Mayor-elect Daryl Steinberg, who is returning to city government after serving 12 years in the state legislature. He served as Senate President Pro Tem from 2008 to 2014. He was the first Senate leader from Sacramento since 1883. and he was a driving force behind the Golden Gate, Golden One Center, the downtown carbon and grid neutral arena that will be on one of the Saturday mini tours. Mr. Steinberg, Marathon.
Carolyn, thank you very, very much. And thank you to Joe. And I want to first say welcome to the capital city. Welcome to Sacramento, all of you. This is an incredible city. I moved here 32 years ago from the San Francisco Bay Area, and kind of think of it like the Bermuda Triangle in a good way. You come here and you never leave because it's an incredible incredible place and incredible region with which to live. And, of course, it's the epicenter of California politics, as we are a capital city. And I must tell you, though, I think my timing in political life is never very, very good. You know, I became president of the Senate in late 2008, and within a month of my ascension, the state budget deficit ballooned to almost $60 billion, and that's what I confronted for the first 4 years of my leadership. And so I'm thinking about tonight that I have to follow Jerry Brown. I mean, I spent 4 years working with, negotiating with, spending a lot of time with Governor Brown, and he never ceases to amaze me. He's a great governor. But the philosophical and the it's like being in a graduate school class every time I listen to him speak, and I think he laid it out right. This is a global challenge, of which California is doing its part to not only improve the climate in California, but to try to lead the way for the country and the world. And I think his message to you is basically correct, that whether you're a government leader, a business leader, a community leader, or a journalist, we all have a responsibility, I think, to tell the story and to educate. And yet I recognize that the world of journalism and your jobs are different than my jobs. Your job is not to just report what I tell you or what Governor Brown tells you. It's always about nuance and analysis. And sometimes I know the frustration of policymakers that in the 24-hour news cycle, that sometimes that nuance and analysis gets lost. And sometimes their decisions appear to be made based on what's popular, what the public wants to hear, as opposed to what may be most important. And yet, those of us who are in this for the long haul, as I know you're in it for the long haul, continue to believe that one, progress is possible, and that two, analysis and nuance is actually possible. And so I thought I would take just a few moments to try and answer a question about climate change and environmental policy that I myself have thought about for a long time. And the question for me is this: do leaders and governments force change through the laws we pass, or do the individual collective choices of people ultimately determine whether change is possible? Nowhere is this question more relevant than in determining how to address this global phenomena of climate change. And it's a question that in some ways frames the traditional differences between political parties and philosophies. And in the political context, of course, it gets blown up and exacerbated. You're either for government action or let people decide what they want to do, and the free market will work out the best solution. And the answer, of course, is neither simple nor unambiguous. My own career and experiences lead me to believe that policy and funding, what we choose to fund, is an essential prod. But behavior only changes in the end if that public policy is combined with and consistent with what people want and are willing to do to change their own behavior and their own lives. Put another way, sometimes policymakers and public policy is consonant and consistent with the people. Sometimes policy and policymakers are way behind the people. And sometimes policymakers and policies are way ahead of where the people are. And I want to take a moment to give you a couple of examples based on my own career and my own story. And it takes place right here in Sacramento. Sacramento is undergoing an incredible renaissance, especially in our downtown. Carolyn talked a moment ago about the Golden One Center, which is our brand new downtown sports and entertainment complex. On the light rail line, in the urban core, it's matched with an aspiration to build 10,000 housing units downtown and make sure that a significant percentage of them are affordable. And so I remember when I started in public life as a member of the city council in Sacramento back in 1992, and one of the first debates we had was whether or not the city should subsidize downtown housing. And the argument went like this. There is no way in the world that people want to live downtown. People want their half acre or more. They want their space. They want their cul-de-sacs. They want to live in suburbia, or at least close to suburbia, where the schools are better and where there are plenty of shopping malls and where you're not hassled by crime and the other indices or consequences of a robust urban life. And that was 1993. And some of us argued, well, no, housing has a future, and we ought to figure out how to keep the housing hope alive downtown. And I remember in 93 we came to a bit of a compromise, and it was fine, and the years went on. In 1998, I was elected to the State Assembly. And in the year 2000, I introduced a bill that was infamous in California called AB 680, which suggested that cities and counties within our region ought to share the growth in sales tax. Now, that's a wonky kind of an idea, but really what it was about was that cities and counties were competing for big box retail and auto malls because under the California system of finance, every penny of sales tax generated in a given city goes back to that city, even if the person who bought the car or the Christmas gift came from another city within the region. And so the incentive then is to fight your neighbors to locate the big box on your side of the border instead of the other side. And so I suggested maybe the growth of the sales tax ought to be shared so that the cities and counties had an incentive to work together. Well, I found my picture, I think, on the post office walls of most suburban cities within the greater Sacramento region because they all thought it was a bad, bad idea, and I lost the bill. Fast forward then to 2007 when I was in the Senate and was about to become a Senate pro tem, and maybe that had something to do with my success because power does matter. And we passed SB 375, which next to AB 32 and SB 32 is probably the most significant, one of the most significant climate change bills that California passed. It dealt with the land use and transportation side. It essentially says that regions who develop smart growth plans that show a reduction in vehicle miles traveled between where people work and where people play and where people shop and where people live, if you can reduce the vehicle miles traveled, you will get more state transportation dollars. In fact, you'll get the lion's share of state transportation dollars. And it was a very controversial bill. Developers fighting the cities, fighting the environmental community, fighting the affordable housing advocates, but we passed the bill, and Governor Schwarzenegger signed it in 2007. This bill now has led to regions throughout the state developing their smart plan blueprints, their jobs, housing balances, and, you know, they're ready to now start implementing these plans. And governments throughout the region, and it's become kind of a craze in a way throughout the country, are embracing the idea of better urban planning and smart growth. But sometimes, as I said, policymakers are consonant, whether lucky or not, with the people. Because what's really happening now, as much as I like to think my bill, because I did work hard on it, is affecting this great social change, what's really happening is that people are changing how they want to live. It's not just the younger generation, because it's cool to talk about the millennial generation, you know, the people under 30 or 35. It's that generation, but it's also older people who are retiring. They want to live downtown. They want to live now where they can walk everywhere they go. You know, in California, 16-year-olds are no longer generally getting their driver's license on their birthdays when they're eligible. And a lot of people under 25 and 30 now living in urban Sacramento don't have a car, period, because they don't want one and they don't need one. And so now the idea of building housing in the urban core is not so controversial. And no longer do we have discussions about the need for deep subsidies. Still on the affordable side, we do. But when it comes to market rate housing, we no longer have a big debate about the need for subsidy, because the people have said they want to live in a different way. One example, it's fascinating to me. One of the ways we're creating affordability in downtown Sacramento is in market rate condominium development now. The developers are beginning to look at building smaller units to create affordability. So some people want to live in condominiums that are 1,200 square feet or 1,500 square feet. But now for $900 a month or $1,000 a month, you can rent at 19th and J, once the project is completed, a 700-square-foot studio. And so we're told again that a lot of people, especially young people, don't want a lot of space. The pull-out bed, the studio apartment, compact. They want to live differently. And so the market and the people are voting with their feet in a way that is consonant with the public policy, that if this trend continues, and now add autonomous vehicles and better transit systems to that mix, and we're improving the climate because we combine good public policy with what people want. Sometimes the policymakers are way behind the people. I talked about the sales tax sharing bill a moment ago. So everybody said that, you know, we were trying to steal their money by changing the allocation of the sales tax. And that big box, everyone had the right to their own big box in their auto mall. I lost. And now what's happening? People are shopping on Amazon. People are getting their gifts and their goods in very, very different ways. There isn't a day that goes by in my household where there's not some Amazon package that been delivered to our door. It's just the way it is. I don't go to the mall anymore. I don't know. Maybe people do. And I know people still go to the mall, and it's not shifted 180%. But the policymakers, in terms of thinking about this public finance system in California, are way behind where the people are. Because we ought not to base our local government finance anymore on who can generate the most sales tax. We ought to be thinking about it differently, because the people are deciding. They don't want the sales tax to be generated in the same way. And finally, sometimes the policymakers are far ahead of the people. And there's Jerry Brown's speech today and why we're so proud of what we are accomplishing here in California. because SB 32 and AB 32 and SB 535 by my successor as President Pro Tem of the Senate, Kevin De Leon, declaring that 25% of the cap and trade money must be spent in disadvantaged communities is changing the debate and changing the society. And it's only the beginning. Because as climate change becomes not just a ice cap and polar bear issue, but continues to become a public health issue, i.e. the high rates of asthma in high poverty Central Valley, California, when the relationship between climate change and other breathing problems and obesity and diabetes become more clear, when it becomes clear that disadvantaged communities often bear the disproportionate impact of a high carbon environment, and when we begin tying public education and career pathways in the renewable energy and green energy field and begin preparing young people from our disadvantaged communities for those jobs in the renewable energy sector, then this issue is going to never go backwards because we will have built a foundation and our economy around climate change and renewable energy. And in that regard, I think California is an example, as you will hear often, of being ahead of where people sort of naturally want to go. You know, we still have a long way to go. People in Sacramento, for example, we talk about getting people out of their cars. People don't want to ride the transit system because it's not good enough yet. We're improving it. And when I'm mayor, we're going to really improve it. But it's not good enough yet for people to feel comfortable and confident that that's the way that they want to commute. And yet we are investing more in transit through our cap and trade investment plan. And we're trying to improve the systems to try to change the behavior. So sometimes, and this gets back to your role, sometimes the relationship between government policy and the people is nuanced. And sometimes the people lead, sometimes the policy and policymakers lead, and sometimes, coincidentally or not, the policy matches up very nicely with what people want in their lives. And so I just thought I would provoke maybe a little discussion about nuance here. Not quite as deep or philosophical as Governor Brown, but hopefully, some food for thought. I wish you a wonderful week here in and around Sacramento and California. And thank you for your public service. I often compare being a politician to being a journalist in some ways. Different sides of the coin. But, you know, they're not always the most popular, highly paid professions. I know journalism, especially print journalism, in many respects has gone through and continues to go through a very, very hard time. And yet, what you do is essential to maintaining public confidence in our imperfect institutions. And where you criticize us where we deserve it, and where you praise us where we might deserve it, but where you report in depth. And that's, I think, the importance of environmental policy. And when you're subject matter specialist as you are, to be able to write in depth or to report in depth about the balances here and the nuances of these issues, this is another form of public service, and I commend you for it. Thank you very much for having me.
Mayor-elect Daryl Steinberg, thank you.
Thank you.
And you take office when? What?
December the 13th.
December the 13th.
That's right.
Thank you.
Well,
now it's my pleasure to introduce Eldridge Moores. He's the UC Davis Distinguished Professor Emeritus of the Earth and Planetary Sciences Department And he mentioned to me earlier, we were talking, he's a frustrated musician, but he said that plate tectonics has jazzed him for life. A little bit of information about Eldridge Moores. He's going to come up and talk to us, and thank you for being here. Come on up.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Can you hear me?
Does this work? It is a great pleasure to be here. I want to thank the Society for Environmental Journalism for inviting me to chat with you for a few moments. As I say, I've been jazzed for life about the subject of geology and what happened to it in the last 50 years. But I also want to thank Capital Public Radio. My wife and I actually donated a car to them a few years ago as part of our support for them. This quote is from James Eggert in a book called Meadowlark Economics, and you can read it faster than I can. It's a long quote. In a pop culture, environmental saturated, et cetera, we need to discover our own cultural rootedness, become intimate with our landscapes and watersheds, to learn, if we can, the land's histories, stories, and songs, to be acquainted with its geology, history, songs, and plants and animals, to feel nourished by a living landscape with our own special place of love and belonging. So my job is here in a few moments to give you a basis of the geologic aspect of our land that we live in. Let's see if I can get this to work.
Got it.
Sorry? Oh. Perhaps we should do it. Yeah, okay, great. Let's do that. Let's see if this one works. Yes, this. Can you see that? I got a slightly larger one here. Okay. That's not much larger. This is a map of the world, to place it in perspective. And what it shows is the plates and the earthquakes around the world. And it also shows these arrows. These arrows are estimates of absolute plate motion. And it tells you, basically, that the Pacific plate, which is this one here, is moving pretty fast to the northwest. The fastest rates on Earth are in this part of the Southwest Pacific, and they're something like about 20 centimeters per year. That's eight inches per year, approximately. And you know the story, probably better than I, that there are three kinds of plate boundaries. There's the kinds of plate boundaries, for example, that you see in the Mid-Atlantic Ridge where the continents or the plates are moving apart. New material comes up in the middle. And there's another one of these south of Australia and up here in the western, west of South America. Then there are plates where one plate goes down beneath another, and you have these rather broader bands of earthquakes coming through here and volcanoes. That's where one plate is going down beneath another. And then there are places where one plate slides past another horizontally, and that's in general where we live here today, coming down through in here. And that's one of the main things. The other main place that one sees a plate boundary like that is in that involving on land things is in New Zealand, and there are a bunch of others. And while these plate boundaries are active now today, it's important to understand that everywhere in the United States, these kinds of plate motions were active at some time in the past. And we could go into detail on that whenever, wherever we want. California is about right in here. Go ahead, next slide, please. I like to, in talks and field trips that we give, introductory things, we like to begin with this sort of schematic cross-section of the Earth drawn approximately to scale, in which you can see the outer layer, the dark line, is the crust of the Earth, which is 5 to 10 kilometers thick in the oceans,
or 35 kilometers or so thick in the continents, and you can't actually show that difference in here. Here is Mount Everest with a slight vertical exaggeration. The plates in blue over here are about this thick. Some of them go all the way down to the core mantle boundary. Some get stuck in the middle in here. And there are a couple of other things, well, a few things. One, there are currents in the outer core that give rise to the Earth's magnetic field. Were it not for those currents in the outer core, we wouldn't be here. Because they are it's the Earth's magnetic field that shields the Earth from cosmic rays coming in from the sun and elsewhere in the universe. Furthermore, in this region down in here, in the mantle, there's probably enough water dissolved in the rocks to exceed the total amount of surface water and groundwater that we see at the surface. But it's obviously not accessible to us. And then finally, over here, you can see in this light band here, that's the atmosphere. And it's the atmosphere. The other thing about the atmosphere is that that's also something that makes our life possible. And without it, we wouldn't exist. And it's absolutely unique in any of the planets that we know about. Can we get another slide, please? Next one. Okay. So this is a map of California, a geologic map, and a relief map that you see over in here. Let's look at the relief map first. You can see there are mountains up in here in the northern part. This band of mountains in here are the Sierra Nevada, the largest range of mountains in the United States, south of Alaska. Then there's this other unique feature in the United States, this flat valley, the Great Central Valley. And one of the questions you always have on that is, why is it so flat? And why is it so low? Why, topographically, when you have mountains and ranges on the west side over in here, and you have mountains in here, all of these are coming up. Why is the valley sitting close to sea level? Good question. Okay, over here we have a geologic map. These pinky rocks are volcanics. You can see over here is the San Andreas Fault coming down through in here. And that's one of the dominant features, it and its branches of California. There's the lighter green stuff in here is stuff that's piled up against the edge of the plate as another plate went down. East of that is this band of darker green, which are sediments laid down on the purple, which is oceanic crust. Then the Great Valley is in here. Then in the Sierra Nevada, you see granites as the red stuff. The green and blue rocks in here are things that began somewhere else than North America, and they've migrated into North America and become a part of it. And again, this is something that you can see in the basement rocks of the Appalachians and also in the mid-continent region. So don't think that your geology is really all that different from California, at least if you go down far enough into it, okay? So, and then the purple stuff is oceanic crust and its associated thing. Mostly it's serpentine, the California State Rock, which has an interesting environmentally etymological history on that. Then down in here, you see the granites come down. If you can see this, down in Southern California, there are some brown areas. These brown areas actually belong to nuclear North America. They are the same age as rocks that you see in the Front Ranges, in the Rocky Mountains, and in at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, and also in places like Nebraska and Wyoming in the subsurface. Okay, next slide, please. Okay. This is another relief map of California and Nevada, and what it has is earthquakes. The earthquakes you can see in here are the red dots. These are actual individual bodies or individual events, and you can see there's quite a few in the coast ranges of California coming down into the LA region and further into Southern California, and there's a bunch east of the Sierras going up into Nevada, and in between, it's relatively earthquake-free. We're actually, next slide, please. We're on what on this map is called the Sierra Microplate. So we're not on the North American plate here. We're on a small plate, which lies between the Pacific plate over here and the North American plate, which is over in Utah somewhere, in because this is also an area that's coming apart in here. And counterpart to that, you see on this map, the gray in here, these are basement rocks in here. These are parts of nuclear North America, whereas the white and colored things in here are things that have been added and come in from somewhere else. Next slide, please. Things began early on, way back. If you went into a time machine and came back 600 to 900 million years ago, we'd actually be connected in a new, in an earlier supercontinent. This one we called, for no particular reason, Rodinia. And at that point, the western margin of North America, here you can see Hudson's Bay. North America in this projection was sort of upside down. And what's now the South Pole was within walking distance of what's now Los Angeles or Death Valley. Okay, I think that's sort of neat, don't you? And so the Pacific Ocean has not been a permanent feature. It opened somewhere like along through here. Next slide, please. So now coming back to a more detailed part of the map of California, this is a geologic map of the state, and you can see Sacramento is about in here. Here's the bay, and then again here the San Andreas is out in here. All the material piled up against the continental margin, which we call the Franciscan, and then the Great Valley sequence is this line of stripes in here. And then over here you see, again, the granitic rocks and the rocks that are older than the granitic rocks but came in from somewhere else. One of the things that geology tries to do is develop the four-dimensional sort of view of the Earth, that is, the three dimensions of it, and then how that changes through in the fourth dimension of time. So what we do is we try to estimate what the third dimension looks like. Next slide shows a cross-section through, again, about from the Pacific here all the way through the Great Valley in here, through the Sierras into here and into Nevada. And in particular, what you see are these, the brown, green, and blue in here are rocks that are piled up against the continental margin. The Great Valley sediments and so forth are in yellow. They sit on top of this green, which is oceanic crust, and that sits on top of mantle, which is in here. That is the layer beneath the crust. And so we have a boundary here between ocean crust and mantle. These arrows are a bit out of place. Sorry about that. And that boundary is called the Moho discontinuity. And so in this case, we have two mohos. We have the main moho down here between the pink and the green and other colors in here, and then a perched moho here from this particular part of a piece of ocean crust and mantle shoved eastward on top of the continental margin. And it's probably that piece of ocean crust and mantle which is heavy and strong, and that keeps the valley sitting low and also makes it relatively earthquake-free. Next slide, please. This is a view, a satellite view from Point Reyes all the way to the Sierra Crest in here. You can see here's the San Andreas Fault, and the rocks to the below the San Andreas Fault in this projection are things that came from way south of the Sierra Nevada. This material in here is mostly the material that's added to the continent during subduction in the last 150 million years. Here's San Pablo Bay. We sit about right in here. The Sierras are in here, and so forth. Next slide, please. I want to show you some cross sections first, or some rocks from west to east. But first, let me start with this. This is a pile, this is a remnant or an exposure of gold-bearing gravels, which were mined in the great hydraulic mining era in California. Here's a pile of debris that was deposited by this gold mining, and here's some of the gravels and more up. And these were derived from what we now recognize as a Tibet-like highland that existed somewhere in eastern Nevada, and you had big rivers coursing westward across what's now the Sierra Nevada. The gold then in these gravels is not the same as the gold you see in the foothill belt, or the so it's different. It actually is gold, and it must have come from Nevada. And it flowed across through here, and it was these gravels that were mined in from 1860 to 1884 by a industrial-scale hydraulic mining in the Sierras. And from during that time, 1.5 billion cubic yards of material was washed off the Sierras into the valley and into the bay. The bay is about a third smaller now than it was in 1850. Okay, and there was this judge, Lorenzo Sawyer, who was a judge of the Ninth Circuit Court in San Francisco, and he put forth in 1884 what's called California's first environmental act, which was the Sawyer decision, which stopped the hydraulic mining in the Sierras. Didn't stop it in the Klamath Mountains to the north. That continued until the 30s or 50s, I'm told. And I think in Alaska, it may well still be continuing, this process of washing things off. But it stopped anyway in the Sierras. So that's a major milestone. And you can see this here is debris that was piled up 150 years ago. It's going to be a very long time before you can't recognize that anymore, till the land completely recovers. And, of course, one of the problems you have both in the Coast Ranges and in the Sierra is mercury, and in the valley is mercury contamination. Mine mercury in the Coast Ranges for use in the Sierras as in the refining process for the gold, and the debris, the remnants of that have been washed into the Great Valley and are a major problem in the Delta in for fish that's being caught by many people in the Delta for subsistence food. Next slide, please. So let's go back a little bit. I wanted to mention this book of Assembling California by John McPhee, and I was very fortunate to go along with him when he was assembling the material for this book. Here he sits, the New Yorker writer stands, rather, looking at this offset ditch. You see that? This is a man-made ditch, maybe 20 years old, and it's been offset about 6 feet by an active branch of the San Andreas Fault near the town of Hollister. Okay, next slide. Most of the material that is, as I say, that's been piled up against the continent by one plate going down beneath North America forms material like this. And what you see here, if you are places where you have blocks of a certain kind of rock or variety of rocks separated by some sort of softer material, a matrix, this picture here turns out to be on the Tiburon Peninsula, just north of San Francisco. Here's the Golden Gate, or the bay in here. And these rocks are called Franciscan for a reason. It's because that's what you see in San Francisco. The hills in San Francisco are blocks in the melange. Full stop. Okay? And then here's some north of San Francisco, about 100 miles, and you can see the coast is very steep here. It's coming up rapidly, and there's a reason for that. Next slide, please. This is actually the Great Valley sequence, which in this place at Monticello Dam, east or west of us here, about 40 miles, is standing on end. And one of the things you have to worry about if you're a geologist is which way is up, you know, and turns out, you know, there's an old phrase, you know, a geologist can't even tell which way is up. Sometimes it's a problem, but you can do it here. And so the sediments get younger as they go to the left here. This thing here is the overflow for this dam. You can see it's down, the water's down quite a ways here, and the water's down quite a ways right now. It's perhaps not quite as far down as this. This picture was taken, I think, in about 1990, something like that. But in 1997, the water in this dam came within a foot of the top, and It was pouring down this thing. If you ever wanted to know what something going down the tubes was, boy, you should have seen the water going down that tube. It began to cavitate at the bottom of the cylinder, and the only reason it stopped was because it stopped raining. Okay, next slide, please. This is a simplified geologic map of the newly named or recently named Berryessa Snow Mountain National Monument, which you can see is this area that comes down through in here, outlined in red. And the picture, last picture we saw was there, if you can see that down in here, and the area outlined in red, there's a bit of the Berryessa Snow Mountain National Monument south of the dam that we just looked at. And there's many reasons for having this as a national monument. There are a unique flora associated with that, especially with these purpley rocks, which are then the serpentine oceanic crust. But also, this heavy line, which I try to show in here, is basically important because it's perhaps the best exposed boundary in the world between material that went down in a subduction zone, that is, going down a plate boundary, and the stuff above that. And that is present, you know, there's some of it, there's a boundary like this in the Appalachians, there's a boundary in the Himalaya, there's a boundary in southwestern Pakistan that's as well exposed as this. But those are places that are not as accessible as this is. This is perhaps the most accessible in the world. Next, please. Okay, this will go. This is an animation on the development of the San Andreas Fault. And you can see as these plates come together, the fault develops in here. It widens in time. This is the time graph here. It comes up to the present time here. And there's now the San Andreas in here, the Gulf of California. It starts again. The Farallon Plate then went down beneath North America, came up. And down in here, there's a piece that will move northward and rotate over 100 degrees. This piece in here will rotate, and that's the San Gabriel Mountains. So the San Gabriel Mountains, just north of Los Angeles, used to be about 400 or 500 miles southeast of where it is now, and they were rotated so that the present east end was the northwest end of that block. So this is what happened evolved, interacted. The darker orange in here is the area that pulls apart. It's where the continent is actually pulling apart. And what that means, of course, is if this keeps going, in 50 million years, you'll have seaside topography, you'll have seaside sites in some place like central Nevada. Okay? Which would, you know, now's the time to buy it. No? Okay. Okay, I could watch this all night, but perhaps we should go to the next one. Okay, so you know, you also want to know what happened in the big one, and this is a view that was published not long after the Loma Prieta earthquake in the Napa Register, a paper in the Napa Valley, and you can see here it says, "Hold on, this could be the big one," and you could see what happened afterwards, right? California remains, but the rest of the country fell into the ocean. Thank you.